miles of black ribbon on the lone highway. Men turn into boys on the lone highway. Rest up creeps cry on the lone highway. Pretty girls beware out on the lone highway. On the lone highway. Revolution Radio, it's Saturday, and it's time for the Scorpio Conspiracy Show with your host, Scorpio. Lost a little honey on the lone highway.
Left me for another. Hello, and welcome to the Scorpio Conspiracy Show. Today's date is Saturday, August 8th, 2020. And welcome to the free-range, open-air, insane asylum we call Earth. Yes, welcome to Corona-palooza, a 24-hour-a-day, non-stop fear festival with all of your favorite stars chipping away at your sense of safety and well-being. The very act of breathing has become a dangerous activity. Walking down the street is now a hero's journey. Or so they want us to think. We've gone from rebel without a cause to rebel without a mask. Yes, the act of walking down the street without a face covering, a talisman of compliance and submission, has become an act of defiance and civil disobedience. The long-forgotten speakeasies from the days of Prohibition are now re-emerging in this modern world. An inconspicuous boarded-up building now houses a covert world of pleasure, of mixed drinks and forbidden social interaction. Just behind the steel door, with a small slit near the top, a guard stands at attention, posted behind it. Don't forget your password or they won't let you in. Clinton body count and Arkanside are two secret passwords that have been rumored to work in the past. But this time, it's not the alcohol that's illegal. No, it's the dreaded social interaction that must be stopped at all costs. If people get together and start talking, uncomfortable questions might be asked, along with some uncomfortable conclusions about the state of reality being hoisted onto the consciousness of humanity. The nightly news should be renamed the Nightly Doomcast, because all they do now is peddle doom and fear, with a nice side helping of Trump hate. Whether you love Trump or hate him, his presidency has proved one thing for certain. The power of the president isn't anything significant compared to the power of the deep state and their agenda that perpetually keeps rolling along with the help of their mockingbird minions embedded within the mainstream media. But don't worry, Groping Joe and his communist minions are going to fix things. Yes, communist minions whose marionette strings are controlled by a shadowy elite globalist cabal who prefers to remain nameless, if you know what I mean. Yes, Groping Joe, along with a black female vice president running mate. Yes, no matter her qualifications or ideological beliefs, that's no longer important. What matters is that she's a black female. Oh, yes. Preferably a lesbian, maybe, too. That'd be even a bigger plus, huh? Yeah, okay. Of course, unless Groping Joe makes the precarious decision to pull a surprise and pick Hillary Clinton as his running mate, which I highly doubt now, despite the claims by many that Hillary has been running a genius stealth campaign for president. It's so stealth you don't even know it's happening. But in the unlikely case that Groping Joe makes the unwise decision to nominate Hillary, I recommend that Joe avoid fatty foods, small airplanes, hot tubs, and steep staircases. Yes, a world-class food taster might be in order as well, just to be on the safe side. Well, that said, I'd like to bring on my co-host, Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. How you doing, man?
I'm just firmly gripping my talisman, trying to get through another day. I'm good. How are you?
Good. I hope you're taking a knee and got your mask on, you know.
I even have a mask for my mask. Of course.
I've actually seen people with two masks on. I guess they just want to be double sure.
Yeah, it's pretty nutty. I was taking my eldest Siberian Husky, we have three, to the vet for a laser acupuncture, working on her spine to keep her strong. And her reward after that is we go for a walk along a creek here outside the District of Criminals, and she loves it, and saw this young woman in really great shape, matching black shorts, jogger, black top, and black mask. Beautiful sunny day in the low to mid 80s early on in the day, and wearing that mask. So sad.
It is sad. And what's really bizarre is I've seen people like actually strutting around with the fancy mask. Like they have like the, you know, the Y-shaped mask with the dual filters, you know, and it's like, I got the deluxe mask with all the bells and whistles, you know. It's just pride of ownership, you know. It's pathetic.
It is really pathetic. And I saw on Twitter right before I joined you that evidently Joe Biden told Fox News he has chosen his running mate, and I think you're absolutely right. Probably going to be Kamala Harris, because she went and had that plastic surgery a week or two ago, and why would you do that unless you're primping for something big?
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow, we got some secret intel coming on the show here.
Yeah, breaking news.
Wow, she had plastic surgery. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, there's amazing side-by-side comparisons of the week before.
Oh.
Her face looked normal, and then this was last week I saw this, where everything is super tight and pulled back, you know, that classic facelift, literally.
Oh, yeah, you can't barely move her mouth anymore. Well, that's good. And, you know, it's so funny how she made her big stand on the debates about busing. Like, that's a pressing issue that, yeah, I want more busing. And, you know, I just remember when I was a kid in 7th and 8th grade, when I was in Texas, people used to live in fear of being bused to one of the bad schools, you know, because, you know, you were in for a year of hell at a school full of people that hated you. But somehow that was a wonderful thing, and that's what people are thinking about today.
Yeah. Busing destroyed so many good neighborhoods. And I lived it in Milwaukee when I was a young boy in the late 60s. And then they implemented that all in the early 70s, and it went from a really stable, nice neighborhood to a war zone that people were desperate to get out of within the span of like 5 years. It was so sad. And that's happened in almost every major city, and it is certainly was rather intentional. And I don't even understand why she's bringing up busing. That has been around, 50 years plus? I mean, why is that need to be an issue now? I don't get it.
Well, I think she was playing the victim card. Like, look, I was a downtrodden, you know, black woman, and the government saved me by busing me to a different school. And, you know, it's just, you know, the social engineers working their magic upon society and really just destroying people's neighborhoods and people's individual lives, all for the greater good, don't you know?
The amusing element to Kamala Harris, other than she's a nasty personality, is that She used to use her formidable fellatio skills on Downtown Willie Brown when he was the head of the state government, and then she was taking care of Downtown until she amassed enough power, and then she cast him aside. I mean, this is like a bad TV soap opera, this woman's story.
Oh, yes, yes. And, you know, apparently she's not well-liked by the people that work with her in San Francisco. And she had the nasty habit of, she put a lot of people in jail for marijuana offenses back in the day, as they say. So, yeah, we'll see. That's very interesting. Basement 5 is saying that Joe Biden sniffed out his vice presidential running mate. So he sniffed her out. Yeah.
He had a good one. He had the finalists kneel down, and he sniffed the hair of each one, and then he knew the right one at that point.
Oh yeah, that there you go. That's actually probably how he did it. Yeah, at least based on that.
Yeah,
and it's incredible how this is the first presidential campaign run from somebody's basement. it's really amazing.
It is amazing. I mean, holy cow! The you would think the Democrats would have, and this is a question I'm going to also ask James Tracy when he comes on in an hour, is you would have thought anyone with half a brain would have grabbed a young, charismatic, futuristic, hopeful candidate similar to what John F. Kennedy was in 1960 and run him against Trump and the corruption surrounding the current government. And they would have won by landslide. And instead, Biden, oh my God, it makes no sense to me. It still doesn't. I mean, holy cow.
Well, I see it, what you're saying, but if you look at it from a different perspective, it kind of makes sense because, you know, Gropin Joe is really connected to the Clinton cabal. So we've got the Clinton influence working, you know, pulling the levers behind the curtain. And in some ways, Joe Biden is the perfect candidate for today's government. He's highly corrupt. He's old, so he has a short shelf life. And he'll pretty much go along with anything he's told because he doesn't usually know what state he's even in. So if you look at it from that perspective, he's actually a great candidate, and he probably won't live very long, which means we'll have a black female president in the very near future. And if you don't like anything she does, you're a misogynistic racist. How about that?
Well, your scenario is very believable to me as well. I guess in some ways I still yearn for a Democratic Party that actually represented to a decent extent the working and middle class like it did in the 50s and 60s, and that's a long gone. You're absolutely right. So I'm being too much of an idealist, certainly.
That is sad because, you know, I can remember in the days of my youth that the Democrat Party did make at least an effort to represent the working people, the working class. Now, of course, they support open borders, and you cannot support the same things because the two things simultaneously, because open borders is really just a race to the bottom for labor. And it's a sad state of affairs that, you know, they're just going to sell out the working class people because, let's face it, you know, they're all taking donations from the oligarchy now.
Yeah, without a doubt, without a doubt. The it's funny that yesterday's guest on The Perfect Triangle, the great John Q. Publius, I didn't get to ask the question, but he describes the illegal workers as the opiate of the dying state. And I think that's so true that, I mean, it's just a cheap way to destroy the foundation of your nation, to steal living wage jobs away, to, you know, sink people into a morass of hopelessness, and which comes with drug abuse, alcohol abuse, violence. It's so obvious that it could be so much more. But the greedy types who want this, they don't care. They guts theirs. They don't care about anybody else, sadly.
Yeah, and you know, as we were saying on the show yesterday, this is really a consolidation of power, and it's an economic event much more so than a health event. And they're really just hiding behind this, keeping people in fear so they don't think about what's actually happening. So right. I don't know. I just think I see this as a last ditch effort to hold on to power as they've had it. And, you know, they're already talking about this global reset, which really, again, is another last-ditch effort to sort of shore up the system as it is, and most importantly, keep their money and their power. And, well, you may hit some hyperinflation yourself, but, you know, if you got $20 billion, what difference does it make?
I'm not so sure that this is a last-ditch effort to hold on to power. To me, it seems like this is a malicious all-in effort to fundamentally transform how globalism controls everything and destroy the sovereign nation known as the United States and meld this country into some type of European-like union, the North American consortium or what have you, and then the dollar's destroyed, the new digital currency, the contact tracing, all the horrific things we've discussed in weeks past. I think they're going for that. I don't think they're trying to hold on to what they have. I think they want to ratchet it up like 20 notches.
Well, no, actually, that's a good clarification. I was really referring to more that I feel that there's a sense of fear within the people that run and own the system. And the fear is that people are starting to evolve a little bit and get to a different state of consciousness. So they're taking a wrecking ball to all of it as quickly as they can to keep their globalist empire afloat.
Oh, on the spiritual plane, yeah, absolutely. There's some grand changes going on energetically, and I think you're absolutely right. It really causes them great consternation, and I agree with you from that perspective without a doubt.
Yeah. So
speaking of fear, should we begin to finish up with the great Dr. Donegan and the New Order of Barbarians?
Yes, let's do that. Because for those of you who may have missed it last week, we played an extensive set of clips from the New Order of Barbarians, which was the revelations given to Dr. Richard Donegan in 1969. While he was attending a pediatric doctor's conference, and he was expecting to hear, you know, the usual kind of doctorly talk, but a doctor, Richard Day, gave this very surprising speech that essentially laid out the plans by a very powerful covert cabal to alter society and steer it into a direction of their choosing.
Right. This was 1969. Sharing the plan to pretty much destroy society by the turn of a century. And it's the things he describes, the massive changes, really, it's taken a little longer. As we discussed last week, they needed some type of massive mind control operant trauma, that being 9/11, to push forward to what they're doing now. And so here we're going to go. With there's about 14, 15 minutes of clips left, and we'll discuss each one. And let me know, just chirp up that you can hear this. Here we go.
Oh, okay, and I just want to make a quick announcement that at the top of the following hour, we'll be welcoming Dr. James Tracy onto the show to discuss the state of academia and what's happened to him because of his viewpoints on Sandy Hook, as well as some other controversial topics. So that's for the next hour.
He's a real hero.
Yeah, Giuseppe, where do you want to start off with the clips here? You got it all queued up?
Yep, we're all set. Just let me know you can hear it.
Okay.
Discussion of terrorism. Terrorism would be used widely in Europe and other parts of the world. Terrorism that at that time was felt would not be necessary in the United States. It possibly could become necessary if the United States did not move rapidly enough into accepting the system. But at least in the foreseeable future, it was not planned and very benignly on their part. Maybe terrorism would not be required here. Implication being that it would be indeed used if it was necessary. Along with a little bit of a scolding that Americans have had it too good anyway, and just a little bit of terrorism would help convince Americans that the world indeed is a dangerous place, or can't if we don't relinquish control to the proper authorities.
Oh, wow, that's really amazing. Talking about the use of terrorism as a way to move the agenda along back in 1969, it must have really blown Richard Donegan's mind as a young man. It must have changed his life forever to hear this speech. And, you know, the other thing about this, these clips, and why I think this new order of barbarians is so relevant right now is that, you know, it actually goes into the concept of medical tyranny. So here we're talking about medical tyranny and terrorism back in 1969.
So two shocking points in 1969. One, nobody even used the word terrorism, and Day says it's going to be used as a tool, which ironically in 1987 or 88, Benjamin Netanyahu gave his famous introductory speech coming out as a player for the Israeli nation, talking about terrorism is in our future and it threatens America and it threatens Europe and it threatens the world, right? So 20 years later that they roll it out. And the other thing that is so shocking and disturbing is in 69, they're saying Americans have it too good and they need to be scared into giving up what they have. Just so evil.
Yeah, and you know what's the other thing that's interesting about this Dr. Richard Day talking about the use of terrorism to move an agenda along? It implicitly implies that they had control of these terrorist groups and that they had created them and funded them and were able to you know steer them into whatever direction they needed.
Yeah. Everything is synthetic. Nothing just happens organically. Everything is there's just like the shocking video a couple months ago in Minneapolis when the operative, be it CIA, deep state, was holding an umbrella and smashing windows, a white spook type, and some local black woman started, don't do that, and he just looked at her, smirked a little bit, kept smashing windows, holding his umbrella, which is the classic sign that it's an op, and then walked away. And so always these things are managed. There is no event in the last, I don't know, forever that just happens. It's always controlled, I believe.
Well, yeah, and here, obviously, you know, they wouldn't be talking about being able to use terrorism as a tool unless they had control over it. And to hear such talk in 1969, it must have been like, you know, science fiction or you know, it must have sounded like, you know, delusional fantasy on some level.
Well, if you think back to 1969, you know, they had a big meal, they're drinking, you know, a lot of cocktailing. These young guys are, you know, feeling their oats, right? They're out of medical school. They've got their board certifications. They're in practice now. They're like, you know, the young guns, right? And then, so they got a little buzz. They got their bellies full and they're sitting there probably a lot of smoking and cigar stuff, manly men stuff of the 1969 timeframe. And all of a sudden the professor, the older guy, drops this bomb of reality, real knowledge, dark knowledge on him. I can't imagine how they'd even process it, and that's probably another reason why so many of them didn't remember it, but luckily Donegan did. And to his
that credit. Is interesting that he even states that a lot of these guys just didn't even remember, or like, oh, I think I remember something like that. But, you know, it's like they just had to wipe it out of their memory. It was just too much to take. But with Dr. Donegan, a seed was planted, and then I'm sure it changed the whole trajectory of his life to some degree.
Yeah, he became a devout Catholic after that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Should we go on to the next one then?
Yeah, we got about 2 minutes till the bottom of the hour. Let's go ahead and hit it. Yeah.
Okay.
There was discussion of money and banking. One statement was inflation is infinite. You can put an infinite number of zeros after any number and put the decimal points wherever you want. This is an indication that inflation is a tool of controllers. Money would become predominantly credit. It was already money is primarily a credit thing, but exchange of money would be not cash or probable things, but electronic credit signals. Money only in very small amounts for things like chewing gum and candy bars, just pocket sorts of things. Any purchase of would be done electronically. Things would be electronically entered into your account. There would be a single banking system. It may have the appearance of being more than one, but ultimately, basically, it would be one single banking system. So when you got paid, your pay would be entered for you into your account balance, and then when you purchased anything at the point of purchase, it would be deducted from your account balance, and you would actually carry nothing with you. Also, computer records can be kept of whatever it was you purchased, so that if you were purchasing too much of any particular item, somebody, official wanted to know what you were doing with your money, they could go back and review your purchases and determine what it was you were buying. There was a statement to the effect that any purchase of significant size, like an automobile, a bicycle, a refrigerator, a radio, or television, or whatever, might be have some sort of identification on it where it could be traced, so that very quickly anything which was either given away or stolen, whatever, authorities would be able to establish who purchased it and when. Computers would allow this to happen. The ability to save would be greatly curtailed. People would just not be able to save any considerable degree of wealth. There's a statement of recognition that wealth represents power, and wealth in the hands of a lot of people is not good for the people in charge.
Oh, wow. So we go from terrorism to talking about essentially a digital currency and the removal of cash from the system.
And that draining the wealth, because wealth equals power. And once again, he thought it was going to happen. Donegan claimed Day said this was all targeted for the end of the 20th century, but they realized they needed that massive trauma, false flag 9/11, to grease these skids, and we're literally seeing it going on right now. That's the whole point of the Great Reset, right?
Yes. And it's interesting how earlier in the tape, Donegan even said that they planned to enter the 21st century with a flying start. I thought that was an interesting choice of words.
Yeah, right. It's just by accident, I'm sure.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing that was interesting about this clip is that the idea that you can just move decimal points around, and you know, it doesn't really matter. It's just numbers on a screen and decimal points, and you can make as much as you want. It really shows you, you know, their perspective of what money is versus, you know, we've been indoctrinated to think, oh, money is so important and it buys things and you have to save and earn it and blah, blah, blah. To them, it's just, you know, decimal points and numbers on a screen.
And it's funny. I remember when I was a little boy, man, you had to keep track of your checking account and balance it yourself. And it was a big deal. And if it didn't add up, you had to get a statement print out from the bank. And it was a lot of work. And now it's all just digital zeros and ones. And even back then, we were still on the gold standard. So holy cow, what a change now. We're now the globalist parasites get to swing their chicken over their head and add another 100 trillion to the economy with nothing back in it. Just insane.
Yeah, it is. It's crazy. And you know, he goes on to talk about this a chip, you know, will be used. First, it'll just be one card. You don't need to have all these different credit cards, just one. And then of course he didn't know that there'd be, you know, cell phones, where that might be an intermediate stage where everything is done with your cell phone to pay and you know, all that. And then, of course, he even talks about an implanted chip, a silicon chip that was being planned in 1969.
So dark, so devious, has to be guided by just pure evil, otherworldly forces. There's no way that any humans could have cooked this all up that many years ago.
I think you said on a previous show that these conspirators are working outside of time. And I thought that was very well said, because it implies that they're working from a different, you know, ether or field of consciousness than human beings are.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, as we discussed last week, and I gave that example of up until the last two or three years, all quantum test where he took some of his blood, kept it alive, put a little bit of it on a plane, stimulated the live blood in the laboratory, and instantaneously the blood on the airplane, which was about 500 miles away and moving further away by the second. Amazingly clever way to prove what we knew, that the ether, or in my medicine, oriental medicine, the chi, the energy that's everywhere, is all linked. It's just these meat bot shells we're in are so limiting compared to what's really going on.
Wow, that's an interesting perspective. Yeah, I totally agree. Okay, well, why don't we go on with the next clip? We're already past the bottom of the hour.
Electronic payments initially would all be based on different kinds of credit cards. These were already in use in 1969 to some extent, not as much as now. But people would have credit cards with the electronic strip on it. And once they got used to that, then it would be pointed out the advantage of having all of this combined into a single credit card serving a single monetary system, and then you don't have to carry around all that plastic. So the next step would be the single card, and then the next step would be to replace the single card with a skin implant. The single card could be lost or stolen, give rise to problems, could be exchanged with somebody else to confuse identity. The skin implant, on the other hand, would be not losable or counterfeitable or transferable to another person. So you and your accounts would be identified without any possibility of error. The skin implant, of course, would have to be put somewhere that was convenient to the scanner, for example, your right hand or your forehead. At that time when I heard this, I was unfamiliar with the statements in the book of Revelation. The speaker went on to say, now some of you people who read the Bible will attach significance to this, to the Bible. But he went on to disclaim any biblical significance at all. This is just common sense of how the system could work and should work. And there's no need to read any superstitious biblical principles into it. as I say, at the time, I was not very familiar with the shortly after that, I became familiar with him, and the significance of what he said really was striking. I'll never forget it. There was some mention also of implants that would lend themselves to surveillance by providing radio signals. This could be under the skin or a dental implant put in like a filling so that either fugitives or possibly every citizen could be identified by a certain frequency from his personal transmitter and could be located at any time or in any place by any authority who wanted to find him. This would be particularly useful if somebody broke out of prison.
Wow. You know, Giuseppe, if I didn't know better, I'd think that these people were working with a much more advanced technology than they were letting on to the public. What do you think about that?
I think that that is absolutely right, Scorpio. And I also just dawned on me that the masks are the training wheels to get people prepared for being injected with that little tracker device, which we know will do a lot more than just track these days.
Oh, that's well said. Training wheels, your training wheel mask. Yes. It's all part of, accepting the idea that the government has the power to force you to wear something over your face and then force you to have a needle jabbed in your arm and then force you to ultimately have a chip to purchase anything.
I saw a poll results released last night that states 42% of the polled respondents would take the coronavirus, which I'm surprised it's that high. I would guess as it comes closer and as more people grok the fact that 100% of all testees got sick, and the higher the dose, the more sicker the testee became, why would anybody take that vaccine?
Yes, I've already decided I'm donating my vaccine to charity because I'm that kind of guy.
Oh, man, what a big heart. No wonder I love you so much. There you go.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, before we move on, I think I'd like just to very quickly give a shout out to the people in the chat room. We've got Jody, Stardust Man, Ken, Strong Delusion. That's a good name. Greenheart 1, Fact or Theory. Basement 5, Snippets, Plant Manager, Zippy 101, Lady Horse, Mona Radler, Marcus, Captain Fred, Mayor Bailey, Vet JD, and Boy Solomon. So we'll be keeping an eye on that, looking for insightful comments. And I liked your little training wheel analogy, because that really is, it's sort of like behavioral modification and getting people used to grander concepts that they're not quite yet aware of.
Yeah, it's really tragic how weak-minded the citizens of most countries are, and that they just go along to get along to go along, which I can understand, because a vast majority of people, even in the Western world these days, the first world, are wage slaves living check to check. I mean, if you're lucky enough to be beyond that, you've done pretty well for yourself, because, you know, what is it, something like 90% of the Western world lives check to check these days. So it's too bad.
Well, and that's partly due to massive inflation that's been dripped out very slowly like an IV onto society. I used to collect these old Desert magazines from the 1960s and 1970s, and there was an ad for a 1965 Mustang, brand new Mustang, for $3,500.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad that the federal government, which should be 120-pound Rottweiler, totally threatening the globalists, the corporatists, and championing we the citizens, and preventing things like hyperinflation, preventing things like deadly vaccinations, toxic chemicals sprayed on our food like Monsanto and the whole glyphosate nightmare. Yeah. Instead, Monsanto, though,
that's pretty good.
Right on. Instead, well, though, we have the federal government is a 4-pound teacup chihuahua constantly licking the hand of the invading globalists and nipping at its own citizens' heels. This government is an embarrassment.
Oh, yes. I wish it was only an embarrassment. Very good wording on that, the teacup chihuahua. That gives a real visual. Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that's interesting is on the previous show, we played the clip where Dr. Day mentions – Dr. Day mentioned that there was going to be new diseases that were to be unleashed onto society. And, of course, every time Dr. Dunnigan had a case that was difficult to diagnose, he started to wonder – well, is this one of these new diseases he was talking about? And, you know, fast forward to today, here we are with a new disease, supposedly.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the new disease that intrepid investigators have tracked for at least 7 years that's been funded by teeny tiny Tony the Rat Fauci and paid for development in labs in first Frederick, Maryland, then it moved to Madison, Wisconsin, then it moved to North Carolina, the Research Triangle Park, and then when Trump and his people had the good sense to outlaw these bioweapons, Fauci moved the development to none other than Wuhan, China. Jeez, what a series of unrelated events, right?
Oh, it's all one big coincidence, Giuseppe, and it's also a coincidence that Dr. Fauci is worth about $500 million now due to his investments in vaccines and laboratory tests. Not bad work if you can find it, huh?
Yeah. The whole idea of this – oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say that most people don't realize that the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, is – not a federal agency. At best, it's a hybrid, and Fauci himself owns the patents on, I think it's some crazy number, like 30 or 70 vaccines, and he co-patents with the people who actually develop it. So talk about vulgar, enormous conflicts of interest. But
he's been feathering his own nest since what, 1981 or something like that. It's really quite incredible.
Yeah, I saw last night that teeny tiny Tony was whining that he and his family are getting a lot of death threats these days. I'm like, I wonder why. Well,
that's a shocker.
I wonder why. Yeah.
Yeah, but then at the same time, the media is saying how popular and his poll numbers are very high. He's very well liked by the general public. But Trump, he's not well liked. So there you go.
He's America's Uncle Mangala, even though was not what he is made out to be. So
there you go. Okay, well, we've only got about less than 15 minutes, so let's play another clip and see what we got.
There was more discussion of personal surveillance. One thing was said, you'll be watching television and somebody will be watching you at the same time at a central monitoring station. Television sets would have a device to enable this. The TV set would not have to be on in order for this to be operative. Also, the television set can be used to monitor what you are watching. People can tell what you're watching on the TV and how you're reacting to what you're watching. You would not know that you were being watched while you were watching your television. Into their homes? Well, people would buy them when they buy their own television. They won't know that they're on there at first. Described as being by what we now know as cable TV to replace antenna TV. When you buy TV set, this monitor would just be a part of the set, and most people would not have enough knowledge of electronics to know it's there in the beginning. And the cable would be the means of carrying the surveillance message to the monitor. People found out that this monitoring was going on, they would also be already very dependent upon television for a number of things. Just the way people are dependent on the telephone today, one thing the television would be used for would be purchases. You wouldn't have to leave your home to purchase. You just turn on your TV, and there would be a way of interacting with the television channel to the store that you wanted to purchase, and you could flip the switch from place to place to choose a refrigerator or clothing. This would be both convenient, but it also would make you dependent on the television, so that the built-in monitor, something you could not do without. There was some discussion of audio monitors too, just in case the authorities wanted to hear what was going on in rooms other than where the television monitor was. And in regard to this, the statement was made, any wire going into your house, for example, your telephone wire could be used this way. I remember this in particular because it was fairly near the end of the presentation, and as we were leaving the meeting place, I said something to one of my colleagues about going home and pulling all the wires out of the house, except that I knew I couldn't get by without the telephone. The colleague I spoke to just seemed numb. He, to this day, I don't think he even remembers what we talked about or what we heard that time, because I've asked him. But at that time, he seemed stunned.
Wow. Well, you know, what comes to my mind is Amazon. You use your television to order everything from a refrigerator to whatever. And then, of course, smart appliances, you know. Your toaster is going to be hooked up to the internet for your convenience.
Yeah, the internet of all things. What reminded me when he said I wanted to pull all the wires out of the house was that excellent. I'm a big Gene Hackman, the actor fan. And he did that movie about, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago called Enemy of the State with young child rapist Will Smith. And that was such a good movie when they come to the realization how much power the intelligence agencies had to monitor your every move. And it's funny that they knew that and could do it back in 1969. It's wow. Amazing.
Yeah, it's almost like if I didn't know better, the technology was already all in place. They just had to decide on a timeline as to how and when to roll out this technology.
Yeah, I mean, they don't operate in a vacuum. There's a lot of good people who have resisted this, and I think that's why it all got delayed for the huge operant trauma of 9/11. And had people been a little weaker-willed and a little less spiritual, especially the Catholics and the Christians of the nation back then, they would have pulled this all off probably by the end of the century. But they realized it wasn't going to work, and then they had to do the heinous false flag 9/11, which interestingly delivered the Patriot Act, which none other than Groper Joe Biden had authored months before 9/11. What a coincidence that is.
It wasn't it one of those 1,000-page documents that nobody could possibly read?
Yes, but Groper Joe was the lead lackey on that.
Well, he was burning the midnight oil on his manual typewriter, listening to his record player, typing up the protocols for the Patriot Act.
The stopping only to step outside, stretch his legs, and sniff the hair of an 8-year-old girl.
Well, we all have to have a hobby, Giuseppe. Come on.
Yes, we do.
It's just amazing, too, you know, the hypocrisy in this whole thing. If some conservative figure had done anything remotely like, you know, being filmed, you know, 20 different times sniffing little girls' hair, can you imagine the outrage? He would have been crucified in the town square. But here, well, it's no big deal. Groping Joe, he's just friendly. That's all.
He's a friendly guy. Yeah, I mean, there's one video I've seen dozens of times where this little girl is, I don't know, 8 years old, and he's reaching with his right hand trying to get his pinky there to touch her breast and nipple area. It's just, and then she kind of brushes him away. I mean, what? Hey, President Groper, it could be coming. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Is that this clip where the little girl's standing there with her parents?
Right. They were the swearing in where he was vice president then. Yeah. And they do each one individually. They all come up the family. It's a big honor for them.
Yeah. And it's kind of sad because the little girl looks up at her mother like, hey, this creepy old guy is trying to touch me. Do something. And of course, you know, the mother has to ignore it because, you know, this is their big moment in the sun. And of course, Groping Joe knew that. So being the predator he is, he pounced on the situation.
Well, that's the excitement. A true addict like that tries to create adrenal charge situations where, oh, if he got caught and the newly sworn in senator punched him in the jaw, it would destroy my career. But oh, I can't resist. I've got to try and do it in public. I mean, they're such sick, addicted lowlifes. That's all they are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess we have time for one more clip, so why don't we crank it out and then make a few comments, and then we'll be at the top of the hour, ready for Dr. James Tracy.
Privately owned housing would become a thing of the past. Cost of housing and financing housing would gradually be made so high that most people can afford it. People who already own their houses would be allowed to keep them, but as years go by, it would be more and more difficult for young people to buy a house. Young people would more and more become renters, particularly in apartments or condominiums. More and more unsold houses would stand vacant. People just couldn't buy them. But the cost of housing would not come down. You'd right away think, well, the vacant house, the price will come down, people will buy it. But there was some statement that to the effect that the price would be held high, even though there was many of them available, so that free marketplaces would not operate. People would not be able to buy these, and gradually more and more of the population would be forced into small apartments which would not accommodate very many children. Then as the number of real homeowners diminished, they would become a minority. There would be no sympathy for them from the majority who dwelled in apartments, and then these homes could be taken by increased taxes or other regulations that would be detrimental to home ownership and would be acceptable to the majority. Ultimately, people would be assigned where they would live, and it would be common to have non-family members living with you, just by your not knowing just how far you could trust anybody. This would all be under the control of a central housing authority.
Wow. You know, the 2008 financial crisis comes to mind when he was talking about that, partially because, you know, so many houses were essentially empty and foreclosed upon, but somehow, miraculously, the prices didn't drop all that much.
Yeah, and how much does what he described sound like the Agenda 2030, the UN's insidious plan to force millions upon millions into the cities and live like rats in a rat's nest.
In a stack and pack, yeah. But, you know, one strange, you know, side effect of this Operation Corona is that that's going to be maybe more difficult because now people are afraid of the cities. There's too many virus-infected bags of flesh, also known as people. And so, you know, people don't want to live in big cities, at least right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's been an amazing rush of real estate. Every type of rural area is, no matter what the condition of the house or no matter the cost, people are rolling their money getting it out of wherever and getting it into something that they can control, which is and live in, which is real estate away from the cities. Because I think especially if the silent majority re-elects Trump, there is going to be riots like we've never seen, and most of the major cities will be gutted, I think.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be a hot time in the old town tonight, as they used to say. And, you know, recently I've watched a few videos of, you know, these guys that sort of just walk around New York City with their video camera, and Manhattan in particular. Saks Fifth Avenue is still all boarded up, basically a ghost town. It's quite shocking. And, you know, I just learned the other day that supposedly 10% of the gross national product of the United States comes from New York City. And New York City is not doing well.
I was listening to a local journalist on a podcast last week, and he observed that 100,000 businesses in New York City will never reopen, and that 500,000 people have fled the city already, the wealthier ones never coming back. So it's only going to get worse.
Yeah, especially because I don't think they have any plans on shutting down Operation Corona anytime in the near future. All indications point to they're going to keep going into next year. Okay, there we are at the music. Next hour, we're going to have Dr. James Tracy, so stay tuned. Okay, and welcome back to hour number two of the Scorpio Conspiracy Show. This hour, we are going to bring on a very special guest, Dr. James Tracy, who is an academic that is in the process of, they're trying to punish this man for him speaking his mind and doing his own research on several controversial subjects. And so, without further ado, Dr. Tracy, thank you for coming on the show. How are you today?
I just heard him briefly. Are you there, James?
Can you hear me now?
There he is.
All right. Okay. I can't hear myself, but I can hear you. Anyway, I mean, I can't hear myself over my my board. You can hear me okay?
Yeah, you sound great. The mic sounds really good. Yeah, you sound really good.
Okay.
Yeah, you sound good. Well, thank you for coming on the show, Dr. Tracy. I'm looking forward to this conversation with you.
Yeah, me too. Sounds like fun.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could just start at the beginning. What was the genesis of your problems with the administration at the university you were at? And just sort of, you know, how did things begin for you going down this path that you're on?
I'm not sure where to begin. I've finished up my graduate work at University of Iowa in communication and media studies and in 2002. And so my first gig, my first job was fortunately a tenure-track position in Boca Raton, Florida, which was I discovered was a great place to be, to live in South Florida. And I had a department that was very welcoming, and it was overall a great experience. In addition, we came here, and my wife, who was in library school, we were not married at the time, but she was going to become a university librarian, or that's what she wanted to do, so she was brought on as well. It wasn't a formal joint hire, but she was brought on, 6 weeks or so after I was after we arrived. And so everything was great. Now, at this time, I must also point out that I was, I think, probably a very much left of center, progressive, whatever you wish to call it, that type of, I guess, as far as the academy is concerned today, the ideal academic or the ideal worldview that would fit right in and did fit right in with the department and the college here and the university environment. And I was at FAU from 2002 until spring, until January of 2016. And during this time, I know, I began looking at various things in the news and alternative interpretations of history, and I had something of a conversion. And this was not only in an intellectual sort of way, but it was also it had to do with my my politics too. I think I became more conservative, and so I became to a certain degree estranged by with some of my colleagues, not all of them, but some. And in 2012, so I was listening to alternative media and not simply things on the left, which I had traditionally listened to, things like Democracy Now! And reading The Nation magazine, but you know, looking at alternative media from a that would be considered or labeled, you know, right wing or conservative, and recognized that a good many of these arguments were firmly, I think, established in historical fact, and so I began a blog. Just as an extracurricular venture in 2012. And it was called, first of all, Memory Gap, and then I think I changed the domain. And so the domain that I could find that was available was Memory Hole Blog. And I wrote, you know, various pieces that were primarily journalistic and historical on the blog. These weren't considered scholarship or they weren't peer reviewed or anything. They were just things that I did in my spare time. And so I began, I think it was in December of 2012, the Sandy Hook shooting took place. And I didn't really pay much attention to it at the time. It was only in hindsight, you know, in the days following the event, because it kind of had an impact on my wife. You know, we had our first daughter. She was in kindergarten at the time, so she was about the same age as those children, you know, depicted in this media narrative. And so, you know, my wife was spooked, so that prompted me to actually look closer at that event. And the closer I looked, the more questions I had. This is just at the reportage, and then everyone, it seemed as if all sorts of policymakers and you know, public figures were just leaping onto this within the course of hours, talking about gun control and what have you. And so I wrote several blog posts questioning the media narrative, and a couple of those I had shared with Michelle Shazudovsky at Global Research, and he posted them, and then they went all over from there. And I think somehow some of the major news media, in particular the Sun Sentinel here, Tribune Company, which owns the Sun Sentinel, caught wind of the fact that there was, you know, a whole set of alternative interpretations of what took place at Sandy Hook. Mine was unique in that I was an academic, and I was a professor at the local university who had this blog, who had a disclaimer on it and everything, but nevertheless referred to himself as a professor with a PhD. And here he is. He's kind of enmeshed in all of these other YouTubers and the like who are calling the official narrative into question. And so the Sun Sentinel wrote a piece and called up and interviewed me, and I had no problem, you know, speaking with the reporter and explaining how, you know, yes, I do classes on journalism and journalistic censorship and things of the like. And I believe that there are a lot of what might be considered deep events that have effectively been censored. Not perhaps this event, it might be too early to tell with the Sandy Hook event, but certainly political assassinations of the 1960s, the most noteworthy ones, if we actually look at the facts versus the conventional narratives by, you know, major academic historians and the like, as well as, you know, more pedestrian ones, we come to the conclusion that many of these events have actually, they've not been represented to the people like they should be. And so that in part is what kind of informed my work, my scholarship from the early 2010s.
Right. Well, you know, so many things come to mind as you're talking, Dr. Tracy. Well, I guess at the beginning, what was the old saying? If you're not liberal when you're young, you don't have a heart. And if you don't become more conservative as you get older, you don't have a mind.
Right.
And so that was interesting. And, you know, what it sounds to me like is what you were doing is you were being an academic. You were taking in information, questioning it, doing research, and coming to conclusions based on that research. And, you know, aside from any kind of political ideology, I come from a family that had many academics in it. And, you know, academia was always supposed to be this search for philosophy and knowledge. And it's supposed to be a full spectrum of ideologies encapsulated within academia. And of course, now that isn't really allowed for some reason.
That's ideally what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be, you're right, various perspectives. Some might be deemed conservative, some liberal, what have you. But I think as we, to bring this up to date, what we are seeing in our streets, for example, in Portland, in Seattle, in Minneapolis, is a manifestation of what's been going on in the academy for an awfully long period of time. You hardly have really any, you have really few, if any, conservative faculty at university, particularly in the social sciences or in the humanities, because they get chased out. The ones that are still there are getting chased out right now. What happened to me in 2016, I think, was sort of a harbinger of in terms of what is happening now with many academics who simply – there was a professor, I believe a dean of the nursing school at University of Massachusetts who said in an email, all lives matter. And she was fired from her position. It's amazing. And this is just one of many cases over the past several months. Where you have this, this has a fairly long intellectual history in terms of where we are now. It goes back decades, but we are seeing it manifest now in how irrational, how crazy our national conversation has become.
Yeah, that's very true. And the other thing that I find absolutely shocking about your case, Dr. Tracy, is that, a tenure was always something that was sacrosanct, and it's something that took, you know, a long time to earn. And once you had it, the whole point of it is that you were protected from being censored or pressured by political affiliations or beliefs. And this attack on tenured professors, to me, is just absolutely shocking.
Yeah, the whole notion of tenure actually came about in the early 20th century by a sociologist economist who was at Stanford. I'm blanking on his name at the moment, but he came under fire because of his remarks concerning immigration at the time. And which would today be considered politically incorrect. But Leland Stanford's widow, who was presiding in part over the university, Jane Stanford, took issue with his views. And even though he had the defense of a number of administrators and his colleagues, ultimately he was fired, and largely because of his public pronouncements. And you know, he was a fairly well-known kind of public intellectual, and he was able to land on his feet. I think that he was hired at University of Wisconsin subsequent to that. But that's where the whole institution of tenure came from, was that particular case and the establishment of the forerunner of the AAUP. The American Association of University Professors, that case is its very bedrock, which took place, I believe, prior to World War One.
Very interesting history. Giuseppe, why don't you jump in?
Dr. Tracy, it's an honor to have you on the show. I've been following your travails, since, Kevin Barrett and others first, covered it. And actually, I was an early follower of when you had your WordPress blog even. And so you at the time you were teaching journalism, and my question as a degree journalist with I'm a little older than you. In fact, when myself and Upton Sinclair were beat reporters, no, just kidding. I graduated the University of Wisconsin Milwaukee in the early 80s, and I began writing for what was then the largest morning daily in the state, the Milwaukee Sentinel. And it was drilled into me every time, especially as you certainly know, when you're a young reporter, you add all this superfluous stuff and you're going to write the greatest story. And then the copy editors just shred it and they tell you, learn from this. And one thing that they always stressed is no opinions in your piece, objectivity as best you can, who, what, where, when, why. And the editorial staff writes opinions. Now all I see are weaponized opinions. What are your thoughts on that? What has happened to the Fourth Estate?
I think that's absolutely true. And it's gotten, you know, it's gotten worse, I think. And it's really, it's come out explicitly following the election of Donald Trump. Where there's it's no holds barred. We just detest this guy. So you have journalists actually getting in trouble because of their posts on social media, or at least getting censured to some degree. They were, you know, up until fairly recently, but they don't even have to have any semblance of objectivity anymore, at least with regard to political reportage. It's why I think in part probably local newscasts are much more honest in many respects, and local media on local issues and things of the like, than what's taking place at the regional and the national level, because it's become so politicized. But, you know, I did my part of my my graduate work at University of Iowa at the School of Journalism and Mass Communication. So, you know, there were academics there. And there were also journalists who had retired into academe, you know, and that sort of almost religion is something that was being undergraduates had then as well. And I thought that it was just really the height of hypocrisy. And it's the same way with academics. Academics are supposed to be objective and what have you. And that's, you know, the reality is that that's not the case. It never has been. Perhaps depending on one's discipline, it doesn't have to be. But if you are given just the topic that you are researching, that you are writing on, suggests your political viewpoints and your perspectives. But political correctness, I think, to a large degree, kind of takes the place of this whole religion of objectivity in the academy. Whereas in journalism, you have the idea of objectivity. And I think it's a good sort of thing to aspire to, but it's largely aspirational. In the academy today, once again, at least in the humanities and social sciences, there's this whole notion of political correctness that everyone has to adhere to. And if you don't adhere to it, then you're simply, you know, these people that speak tolerance will not tolerate you. And you're more or less shown the door, either formally or in so many ways. And one hand has to wash, maybe that's not the right expression, but you realize that you have to make a great many kind of accommodations when you're in the academy, and you can only challenge the status quo so much, because you're dependent on things like letters of recommendation. And, so most people just, they go along to get along. And I had when I was terminated, you know, it was obvious that it was a threat against the whole institution of tenure. But there were really almost no academics at the time who spoke out about the case. And I think that it was because of the controversial nature, the controversy that was ensuing at the time of the termination essentially justified the termination. In other words, this false allegation that I was criminally harassing parents of Sandy Hook victims, which was not the case, but the media and even the New York Times, you know, which is supposed to be the bastion of objectivity, you know, we know that's yeah. that's certainly been that's not the case. That couldn't be more plain throughout the presidency of throughout the Trump presidency. But even you have the New York Times saying, "Oh, he's a conspiracy theorist," and you know, this sort of thing can't be tolerated. He sent this letter to the parents and all this. So anyway, I think that even academics who might have been inclined to come to my aid were very frightened and intimidated about being labeled with the fairly broad conspiracy theory brush, if you will. And so, yeah, you know, that's kind of the this is probably more than what's more of an explanation or response than you bargained for, Giuseppe. But I've, there's a lot to say about that. But, you know, I think that once again, the idea of objectivity is something that's I think it's an important thing to strive towards, but realistically, it's something that I don't think it can be realized.
I thought your explanation was extremely lucid, and I love the fact that you pointed out how so many of these things become a pseudo religion for people. We're like hardwired to feel like we're on some type of noble or sacred quest, and my follow-up question is, what do you think would have happened had the government not turned into such a compliant tool for the corporatists and the globalists? And what would have happened had we maintained the fairness doctrine, whereby you could only own 7 radio stations, TV stations, or newspapers? And clearly it would have had to have been amended somewhat for the internet, but the general principle would have remained.
Well, yeah, the 777 became 14, 14, 14, and 21, 21, 21. And then I think that the floodgates were opened under the Reagan administration in the late 1980s, where one entity could own 7 a.m., 7 f.m., and I believe 7 television stations initially. And then it was, you know, the sky was the limit, more or less. Well, I think in a nutshell, it just makes it a lot easier to manipulate the media, because you have to deal with fewer parties or fewer entities in order to do so. So if you had, you know, some of these mass casualty events are obviously, you know, staged. And I'm not going to say any particular one, but one could do – I've done analyses on these, and that's more or less my conclusion. But it in 1980 – it would have been likely a lot more difficult to do something like that, because you had a plethora of journalistic outlets, managements, and ownerships, and one would have called the other out on the carpet. And today, that's, you know, over the past 15, 20 years, especially since the Telecom Act, too, of 1996 under Clinton, you have greater and greater consolidation. And and, you know, Ben Bagdikian, who was a former assistant editor, you probably heard of, Giuseppe, at the Washington Post for years. You know, he was also at the UC Berkeley School of Journalism as a faculty member. And he wrote this very well-known book that went through like 8 editions called A Media Monopoly. And every time a new edition came out, you know, the number of stations and or number of owners shrank. You know, it was like 50 when he began this, wrote the first edition of this book back in 1980, 81. And I think when he wrote the last edition in 2006 or 2007 or something, or somewhere in the mid-2000s, it was down to like 4 or 5. You know, that owned the bulk of these.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, Dr. Tracy, you know, it began under Reagan, and then Clinton finished up the job along with the son of I forget his name, the general Colin Powell. Colin Powell's son. And so it was a bipartisan effort, kind of like NAFTA, which was began by George H.W. Bush, and then finished by Clinton.
That's right. Yep. Absolutely. So as I mentioned, I think that it's just that much easier for if you are going to present an event, then you can restrict coverage. You can restrict how that event is portrayed in any number of ways, at least in mainstream outlets. Now, fortunately, since the 96 Telecom Act, you have social media, you have YouTube and Twitter and Facebook. And I think that that you had all of these alternative perspectives that were coming out following these, for example, mass casualty events. And now you have these platforms that are censoring as well. I came across a meme this morning that I thought was pretty good, and it essentially states that how can you tell what truth is? Well, Facebook and Twitter are deleting the posts, and YouTube is banning the channel.
Wow, that's very interesting. Okay, we're at the bottom of the hour break, so everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back with Dr. James Tracy. Okay, we're back here on Revolution Radio on the Scorpio Conspiracy Show. I'm Scorpio, and I'm here with my co-host Giuseppe and Dr. James Tracy. Before we re-enter our discussion, I would just like to remind everyone to please come on to freedomslips.com and make a donation and maybe become a Patreon subscriber. Because, this is a true bastion of free speech. Many points of view are represented on this radio station. And given the subject that we're discussing right now, it's imperative that free speech be preserved right now because it is under attack. So that said, Dr. Tracy, I was looking through, some of the details of what happened in your case, and I'm just actually shocked that that the university has these rules where they require the faculty submit forms for outside activities to be vetted for administrative approval. I don't see how that's possibly legal unless you are doing some kind of activity that is against the law, and I'm just amazed that they're trying to stand on this for their defense. I don't think they have a leg to stand on, and I honestly think you have a very strong case, and I wish you absolutely the best in all of this because this is a true injustice, what happened.
Well, thank you. I think that the attorneys that initially took on my case were concerned with and attracted to the fact that this policy was being used to suppress speech, to potentially suppress speech as a tool that could be arbitrarily used to come down on any staff or faculty member that with whom the administration did not agree with their views or with what they were doing. And so that's really kind of the thrust of the case. That is what we are challenging at the appellate level before the 11th Circuit. Now, the case presently is before the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. Now, at the trial level, the judge essentially threw out about 4/5 of our case. So I believe 5 of the 6 counts were just thrown out. And we were actually suing the provost and my dean and the president of the university as well. The president of the university was removed from the case by the judge, and the provost and the dean received immunity because they were working for the idea.
Wow. They
were working for a state institution. So
immunity.
All
that
of this
is
well. That's that's. This is one of the things that I think underlines the at least the kind of the argument that some of the Black Lives Matter activists are asserting, that and actually it is true, the fact that they're, you know, instances of police brutality are allowed to proceed because police are able to claim immunity because of the fact that they work for the state. And I don't agree with all the tactics of that are going on, and this has gone far beyond any sort of civil rights protest or anything of the like. But this is the same case in a more sort of administrative or white collar way, where these individuals who do work for a state institution are able to hide behind the notion of immunity. We see this. There are a number of governors now that they foresee civil lawsuits, and they're trying to – there was just something about this in the media yesterday. They are beginning to cling to the notion of immunity as a defense because of the actions that they are carrying out with this, you know, so-called pandemic that's taking place, that you know, people are being killed, and they're refusing them treatment with things like hydroxychloroquine. So yeah, there's a lot to be said about that. But anyway, they were removed more or less from the suit. And what I think is even more disturbing is the fact that the real civil rights thrust of the lawsuit was vacated, at least at the trial level. And we had a judge that unfortunately saw the arguments of FAU, my university's defense, as being more viable, as being more acceptable than what we were asserting. And this was, you know, after we went through collecting tons of stuff in discovery. We were told that a lot of it could not be used. It had to be, you know, we had, for example, one of my colleagues essentially admitting to having knowledge that there was a plan to get me out the door. And that was something that could not be used because the defense attorneys were successful in walking back his testimony and getting him, you know, intimidating him more or less, given the fact that this person at the time was untenured. So, yeah, I mean, that was just one example, but there are so many I could go on and on. This is something that in many ways has kind of dominated my life over the past several years. And at the same time, in a certain respect, I think that it is worth it. But now we see see that universities and administrations and really just kind of the whole broader political landscape has changed. Whereas we were talking several years ago about I was suggesting that, you know, a lot of these mass casualty events really should be looked at more closely, because I think that we're being sold a bill of goods. Well, what's taking place now is we've got this pandemic or plandemic, you know, which some people call it, which I think is quite appropriate. And we're living the lie. We're living the lie. You've got to put some states you can't leave your front door without putting a mask on. So it's not a matter of simply accepting or not accepting the quote unquote reality that is being presented to us day in, day out by the mass media. Now it's something that you actually have to live, right? It's something that you're denied service, or you're denied the sale of goods if you don't have a mask on. You know, you can't go to the grocery store. You can't do this. You can't do that. So I think that it's been ratcheted up. You know, if these people, if the general populace is going to be accepting of these narratives that we see on television that do not, you know, the closer you look, the less plausible they seem. Well, then we can actually have a major public health pandemic. And, you know, well, maybe it's in part just a beta test. We'll see how far we can push them. How many people will take any, will be accepting of any type of vaccine or set of vaccines or other types of things in order to gain access to the marketplace, or, you know, maybe eventually gain access to the internet. Maybe that's
well, and it's interesting how you brought up the concept of immunity, and immunity really is, you know, the last refuge of the scoundrel, it seems like, because here these people actively try to destroy your career and your livelihood because you said some things or held some opinions that they didn't like. And here, you know, with the vaccines, of course, they have immunity from damages as well.
Right. Yes, that's absolutely right. Yep. Since 1986 or 1987. It's pretty amazing. And, you know, if you ask your family doctor, ask the typical pediatrician, many of them are unaware of this legislation. They don't want liability themselves, but they're unaware of the fact that the patient has very little, if any, recourse if their child is vaccine injured. And the burden of proof is upon the family and the parents to demonstrate that their child was, in fact, injured by a particular vaccine. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Those who have power over us are hiding behind these various shields of immunity.
You know, 2020 has been an insane year so far. Every major event feels to me like it's not organic in the way it's rolled out, especially by the media coverage. In February, the pandemic phase one appeared. Then the St. Floyd of fentanyl sacred riots of Antifa and BLM. Then the pandemic phase two. It seems all staged, like we're watching a play. It seems so synthetic. What are your thoughts on that statement?
I think you're absolutely right. And there are these cycles that are taking place up until November 3rd specifically, I believe, that you have the party that does not presently hold complete power of Congress and does not have control of the executive branch. And they've been screaming like little children since 2017. And it's amazing, actually, that Trump has been able to accomplish what he has accomplished, given the fact that he's had to, you know, he's had to fend off this, you know, this Russian collusion investigation and all that's taken place there. I'm sure that he has to be wary of individuals that he brings into his cabinet, that he shares information with and the like. And yet he's under the circumstances, he's done an incredible job. But I believe that the unloyal opposition, if you will do pretty much anything to get control of power. And this is not the Democratic Party of JFK or of President Roosevelt or anything of the like, FDR or Jimmy Carter. It's become radicalized. Now it's, you know, essentially a socialist, communist party. And this is evident, I think, in what's taking place in the streets, and that they will what they want to do, I believe, is to goad the Trump administration into having an event or doing something similar to what the Nixon administration did at Kent State, or what they were prompted to do, or what ultimately took place, because then they can turn around and say, well, Trump is a tyrant. He's killing people in the streets. And they've shown an incredible amount of restraint, I think, up until this point, at least the Trump administration. And even what they have done in terms of attempting to defend, various federal properties, for example, in Portland, I think has been mild to moderate, given what they are up against. But, it's a revolution, and I think that regardless of what takes place, unfortunately, in November, it's all hell is going to be breaking loose by then. It is now, but I think it's going to intensify as we approach the end of the year. It's very unfortunate. You know, this brings up a good point, and I think we were talking about the first half of the show about media monopolies. There's this group that just issued this report, and they tout themselves as being this nonpartisan group, the Transition Integrity Project. Have you heard about this?
No, please explain.
Okay, well, it's essentially it's gotten all sorts of play in the conventional media. It's, you know, the Boston Globe did a big piece on it, and I think it was in the New York Times, and it was on National Public Radio and elsewhere. So the Transition Integrity Project was this it was essentially this how shall I say? There's this organization behind it, and I can go into further detail because I've been researching it for the past few days, but because I was interested to find out who actually is behind this. But they build themselves as being nonpartisan, but they couldn't be more partisan. They are they're doing this game. They did this game, I believe, a couple of months ago, where they got a bunch of people together to simulate the situation that would take place in November during and after the election if there was a narrow Biden victory, if there was a narrow Trump victory, if there was a, you know, because they're essentially saying that, well, Trump is probably going to try to hold on to power because he will contend that the election might have been stolen. And, you know, that claim, his claim has a lot of validity because the Democrats are pushing this mail-in voting, right? And there are all sorts of ways that one could steal the election, you know, stuffing the ballot boxes and ballot harvesting. And yet Trump is – the way in which his allegations are framed is that he's just this lunatic, when I think that they have a great deal of credence. So anyway, this group is saying their assumption is that there's going to be a very tumultuous transition of power. And it's because Trump is a maniac. Yeah. that's essentially. So I was doing a bit more research and on this, and the people that are behind it. This one person that's heading it up, her name is Rosa Brooks, and she's a professor of law at Georgetown University, and prior to that, she served in the Defense Department of the Obama administration. And she, prior to that, around that time, she was also a counsel for the Open Society Foundation. Another person that's behind it is the director of programs at this what is called the Berggruen Institute, which is based in Los Angeles. But it was founded by Nicholas Berggruen, who is this billionaire. I don't know if you've ever heard of him or not, but he's all about now his Twitter masthead says a believer that ideas can make a better world. So these people are, you know, liberal socialists, what have you, but they're masquerading as intellectuals. And he's the one that I believe is funding this, his organization. But I think only the Boston Globe has made mention of it yet. But I'm just wondering, there are also other connections to the Open Society Foundations and to George Soros. So is Mr. Berggruen also one of the individuals that is helping to fund the pallets of bricks that we're finding in the midst of this BLM rioting? This Transition Integrity Project seems to me to be another way to kind of gaslight the Trump administration. And to float the narrative months before the election that the Trump administration is going to attempt to hold on to power because of you know the Biden victory. And that the Biden victory is a given. They're using this also. They're using the 2000 election, you know, the Gore Bush election, as kind of a basis to some of their assumptions and kind of prognostications on what they believe will take place. But it's totally partisan and it has the pretense of, you know, of being academic or objective, again, is what we were discussing some time ago. Couldn't be further from the truth. This is clearly politically motivated and something to look at if you have a moment.
That's very interesting. And, you know, what's interesting as well is that whether you love Trump or if you hate Trump, One thing that's become clear is that the president really doesn't have all that much power compared to the power of the so-called deep state or the secret government. And you were mentioning all of these billionaires that are influencing things. It's increasingly looking to me like we live in an oligarchy. And right now, what's happening due to this Corona, Operation Corona, is that the oligarchy is in the process of consolidating its power and consolidating its assets.
It looks that way, doesn't it? I'd certainly agree that that is what is taking place. And I don't know. I seriously doubt that every billionaire is necessarily involved, but they're likely aware of what is taking place, much more so than the general public. You know, if you look at things like Agenda 21 or Agenda 2030, if you look at large institutions, large, you know, transnational entities like the United Nations and the World Economic Forum, they have plans that are likely being rolled out and will be for the foreseeable future, and they're looking at decades ahead of time. And so look at what happens when you have to go into the supermarket to get groceries. Now you got to walk a particular, you know, one direction down one aisle and one direction down the other, or at least you're encouraged to do so. And I think most people just want to, you know, go along to get along. And so that's what they do. And to stand 6 feet apart and to wear your mask. I think these are signs of what may very well be in store for us. And might have happened a lot more quickly if the election, the presidential election, had been reversed and Hillary Clinton won in 2016.
You know, it's interesting that if you think about it, ever since he was elected, the vilification of Trump, just absolute sabotage, absolute anger, absolute disrespect. And yet he's given the controllers at the globalist level everything they want. Move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, more money via tax credits and revenue sharing. But it seems to me that the controllers, especially the Bolshevik communist controllers, most represented by Yorgi Schwartz, a.k.a. George Soros and his Open Society, what they hate even more than Trump is the fact that the good citizens of the so-called flyover states elected him. And that is who they're really targeting in all this. And to me, it's become increasingly obvious that the way they vilify white decent people with the so-called white privilege, when in reality the only privilege is oligarchic privilege, celebrity privilege, governmental employee privilege. It's certainly – there's no white privilege that I'm aware of or I've lived. And so what are your thoughts on that's the real target?
Well, that's been going on for decades. I think probably the seminal work in that regard is The Authoritarian Personality, which was a study done by the Frankfurt School, a group of emigre Jewish scholars from Europe, from Germany primarily. And I often wondered why that book was never assigned to us when I was in graduate school. We discussed it, but it was never assigned, and there was just this kind of vague response. Well, you know, the Frankfurt School, they're kind of pessimistic, and they're passé now. Well, I think one of the reasons it wasn't assigned is because if you actually open up the book, you'll find that the study was funded by the American Jewish League. So anyone would look and say, oh my God, this is political propaganda. But that's it's a piece of very shoddy social science anyway, done by a bunch of individuals that are primarily trained in philosophy and psychology. And so, but it was used to kind of a social science, an argument that had social scientific artifice or cover to contend that that European families, European Christian families, were the source of fascism. That's why fascism arose in Italy and Germany and Spain. And this argument is something that one could, you know, drive semis through. It doesn't hold up. And even at the time that that study was released, there were a lot of social scientists calling it out, saying that this is not sound research. And yet it's something that's has been tremendously influential ever since then.
Yeah,
but it goes back, you know, goes back 70 years.
Science, that's well said. Go ahead, Giuseppe.
Well, I was just going to ask Dr. Tracy if he would be willing to stay another hour if he has time. This has gone so fast, and we could take calls possibly and continue the discussion.
Well, I could stay. I could stay to the bottom of the hour.
Oh, wonderful!
Sounds great. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and let's give out the call number in case anybody wants to call in and pose a question to Dr. Tracy. The call-in number is 703-879-8880. 703-879-8880. And I really thought that your term, shoddy social science, is actually very, very accurate and very well said, because that's precisely what it was. But of course, it was never questioned.
No. Not like it should have been, because you want to go along to get along and get tenure.
Right. And that doesn't seem the way that academia should work. It should be an open exchange of ideas from all spectrums of ideologies. That said, we've got the music coming up for the top of the hour, so everyone stay tuned, and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back for the third and final hour of the show. We're having a really interesting discussion with Dr. James Tracy. And Dr. Tracy, I wanted to make sure that we got into Sandy Hook a little bit. But before we do, I wanted to make sure that you're comfortable talking about that right now.
Well, it depends on what you want to talk about.
Okay. Well, I was just going to ask you, just for starters, what started to pique your curiosity about Sandy Hook? And, you know, when was your aha moment that you thought that there was really something wrong with the story?
Well, as I mentioned, I think in the first hour, I was something that was just dominating the national conversation. You couldn't ignore it. And I recall that my wife actually brought it up with me, and she said, "You hear what happened in Connecticut today? It was just awful." And I think I'd heard about it to a certain degree, but I you know, just kind of in passing. And that caused me in part to look at it a bit more closely. But as it was taking place, it was like almost a week after it actually took place that I think I wrote my first post on it, on the 20th of December. And then I wrote another post because, you know, we had downtime and it was, you know, Christmas break. And I think it was Christmas Eve day, and I sat down and I wrote another post, and I transcribed a good part of the press conference between H. Wayne Carver, who was the Connecticut medical examiner who was presiding over the autopsies there, and the media. And for one, he looked very uncomfortable just watching him. But then when I sat down and began verbatim to transcribe what he was saying and try to make out what the questions were, and for a portion of that post, of that article, I was saying to myself, wow, you know, this guy doesn't know really what's going on. I come from a medical family, so I was had all sorts of stories when I was growing up. My grandfather was a doctor. My uncle were both physicians. And so my dad was like the son of a doctor. So you'd have all sorts of stories. It was a country doctor, you know. But nevertheless, coupled with listening to this interview, or excuse me, listening to it, transcribing it, and looking at it much more closely, I said to myself, how could this guy really have presided over, you know, this horrendous, you know, set of autopsies? It's just, and in addition, why is it that he's able to laugh and treat it kind of like a joke and not actually have the information and the responses that a medical professional would have? How is it that parents are not outraged? How is it that they were not able to see their children, see the children's bodies? I mean, I've got five children. If anything ever happened to any of them, I'd it'd be tragic, but I'd want to see, you know, unfortunately, the remains for some sense of closure. But in this instance, yeah, everyone parted with just photographs. So, you know, this coupled with all sorts of other just unusual and anomalous things in the coverage, it didn't really add up. And then one of the subsequent posts that I did was like this ongoing project where it was just a timeline of news stories from alternative and major news media, and just posting a brief synopsis of what the article was about, what the information it provided, and a link to the given article. And that was, you know, that went on and on and on for the course of over a year in the aftermath of the event.
Yes, and you know, Dr. Carver certainly was a very suspicious individual with his behavior. And at the very least, Dr. Carver is quite a name for someone that was doing autopsies, you know, a very strange name there. Right. Yes.
Yeah. But it was and remains an event that people are very sensitive about because it's something that involved children. And so making the suggestion that anyone would ever tug at our heartstrings and with a narrative like this is just almost unspeakable. Who would ever, you know, do that? You know, sure. It suggests a great deal about the Obama administration, because they had just been reelected and they wanted to push you know, gun control that was being that was also being proposed by the United Nations. We were, you know, a signatory to this treaty that they wanted to be able to get through Congress. And it's interesting, you know, when you're sort of at the center of a media firestorm like that, a lot of people come forward too. And there were a number of people that that wanted to contact me and speak to me about the event, some of whom, you know, had some details and so forth that I thought were pretty compelling. It's almost, you know, do I really want to know this stuff? You know, I had all sorts of messages being left at my voicemail at my place of employment concerning information and people that wanted to add to the body of knowledge that I at the time was assembling. And some of it was, you know, was pretty disturbing. And then you also had parties that were contacting me and, you know, saying, you know, how could you bring anything like this up? This is, you know, this event took place exactly as it has been presented in the news media, and you should just be quiet. And so, yeah, it's quite a bit of activity at the time, and quite a bit of information that was coming my way. And I think a great deal of pressure also to on my employer to get me terminated. You know, it's like, as we were discussing earlier, it's like what's happening today with a lot of professors. But now university administrations don't even need to be prompted any longer by public pressure. It's just, they just almost do it as in a kind of knee jerk sort of way. Just, oh, this person, you know, they said something bad, they're fired. There needn't even be a kind of campaign by the news media or activist groups or what have you to get these people ousted from their positions, tenured positions. It's amazing.
It's interesting that after having read Dr. James Fetzer's book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, having watched hundreds of videos produced, some of them really of high integrity, journalistic integrity, for the years when you used to be able to watch things like that on YouTube. I think the French summed up the Sandy Hook initiative in one word: bullshit. And it's just, it's sad that the American population, going back to the Frankfurt School thread, has been so dumbed down to no longer be able to critically think, but to feel. And, you know, it's one thing to, you know, everybody loves children, everybody loves puppies. Unless you're a true psychopath, that's a given. That's not the issue. The issue is, how did this weird-looking 110-pound kid drag 120 pounds of real military gear and in a few brief moments strap it all on? I mean, everything falls apart when you just apply investigative journalism to it, but you can't do that. It's sacred. Once again, going back to the Frankfurt School, one of the most insidious elements was their ability to mind control people. Sigmund Freud, all of them, they were like desperate to figure out how to mind control people. And it seems like over the decades, there's been this operant trauma conditioning, you know, Kennedy's assassination, the public ritualistic execution, the 9/11. And then you pointed out exactly correct that the Obama administration with their globalist agenda was desperate to get some type of gun control pushed through. I mean, it seems like this is not all happening in a vacuum. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that it's true that people certainly do not have the critical faculties that they arguably once had, but it's a big question. I mean, where do you begin? Because at one time in our country's history, there was just a much greater belief and reverence for the integrity of our institutions. And a lot of that changed with Watergate. You know, the idea that the nation's chief executive could do what he was being accused of doing, and apparently did, because he went ahead and resigned, right? But this, I think, was beyond a lot of people's even imaginations, certainly a majority of people at the time. So it's just a really, really big question. But I think that our educational system today, and I'm talking about public schooling, is less of a service to young people in terms of getting them to think critically. And they take this very model that you're suggesting and they apply it where people are supposed to feel more so than actually think, and think critically and think for themselves. So, you know, unfortunately, what our oldest daughter goes to, she attends public school here in South Florida, and she's a smart girl, but I hear these assumptions from her all the time, like, oh, well, you know, so-and-so is racist or sexist. And, you know, this has nothing to do with critical thought. This is a political ideology that has been inculcated in her, you know? And I try to challenge her on this. You know, what exactly do we mean by that? And, or she'll, you know, we were talking about the election last night, and she said, well, I think that Biden is, you know, he's obviously a pervert, and Trump is racist and sexist. You know? And well, let's tease that out, you know. And it's difficult to argue with a 14-year-old because they think they know everything. But it's just an example, and it's been going on increasingly so for decades, and where now I'm afraid that students, young people, and it's obvious, you know, given what we see in the streets, they see the establishments, whatever they perceive to be up against, as being, you know, this white European privileged class. and yet we have had things in place in this country for decades, like affirmative action, and so forth. And have these programs done any good? If an immigrant family wants to come to this country and send their children to university, they are able to do so financially much more easily than those of us who pay taxes here can actually do, right? Because they're given a tuition waiver in some states or complete tuition remission. So, you know, once again, this is a really big question, but it's been going on for some time. A lot of it definitely has to do with social engineering. There's no doubt about that. And so, but I unfortunately, what's taking place at in grade school, middle school, high school today, I'm afraid, is just a kind of political correctness training that is continued and augmented at the higher ed level, at college and university. I think that the higher education, the paradigm of higher education today, is going to have to be completely revamped, and that might be a good thing. Where you kind of drain the higher ed swamp to a certain degree. It's just going to be a given, because a lot of families that had small businesses, they don't have an income anymore. They've been destroyed. It's like we've been through a war just over the past 6 months because of this this whole corona pandemic. So people are out of work. So they're not going to have the money to send Sally or Johnny to school anymore, off to university. And it's not going to be a priority anymore. And it's questionable as to whether or not it's a value anyway. I would contend that it probably is not. Perhaps unless you are going for a degree that it can be converted to, you know, to a job, to something whereby you can, you know, actually apply it in the marketplace of employment.
Yes, and you know, you mentioned the public schools, and I think, you know, it's been an unmitigated disaster what's happened to the public schools, and there's no question in my mind that public schools, or schooling in general, the universities, we need to go back to classical education, and people need to learn the great literature, the great philosophers, the mythology, go back to the things that really educated people and teaching them how to think. Not inculcating them with some kind of political ideology.
But that would be politically incorrect.
Because all that's racist, of course.
Right.
Yes.
You're talking about.
Okay. And, you know, with the people tearing down the statues, it's very sad, because it's not only an attack on the people that those statues represent, but it's also an attack on art. And these people don't have reverence for the kind of devotion and training it took for these artists to create these works of art that were displayed in public. They just tear them down like it's garbage, without any appreciation for the beauty and the devotion that the artist had to create that.
Well, these are also historical artifacts, whether you like the history or not. History is not supposed to be something that feels good. You know, it's a record of where we've been. It's an interpretation of where we've been. And if we can't tell where we've been, if we don't know where we've been, how do we know where we're going? That's why I think there are a great many more kind of communist characteristics of this protest movement or program or project than a lot of people really want to admit, because a great many people have a very limited interpretation of 20th century history and what took place and the conditions out of which fascism and Nazism arose in Europe. But what the communists seek to do is to erase history.
Absolutely.
To eliminate
it. And it's funny, you know, Mussolini was a lifelong socialist before he created fascism. So that's an interesting little fact, isn't it?
Well, one of the things that's omitted, I think, from the historical narrative is the Red Terror that took place in Russia and in Eastern Europe as well. Through the late teens and through the 1920s, and the mass extermination of mostly Christians, and this is something that's bracketed off from the narrative, right? All of a sudden, Hitler came to power, and he came to power because German people were bad. They let him come to power, and so there must be almost a kind of genetic thing, right? This is something that is affirmed in things like the authoritarian personality. Whereas it's much more complex than that. And you had patriot militias back in the late teens and early 20s staving off communist revolutions in Germany, in Berlin and Bavaria, the Freikorps, the people recognized that these communists were going to overthrow the government. They successfully did for a short time, for example, in Bavaria, overthrow the government and carry out mass executions of their enemies. And that's one of the things that bolstered Nazism in the early 1930s. A lot of people are searching for they trace the history of Antifa, of the anti-fascist movement, to the early 1930s, right? But that was a reaction to a reaction to a reaction that had been going on since the end of World War I in Germany specifically. And I think the citizens of Germany, of Italy, of Spain looked at what took place, for example, in Hungary under the regime of Bela Kun over the course of several months, where you had tens of thousands of people who were executed. But all of these things are not considered. And so people have a very, very compromised, limited understanding of that, the historical narrative and the kind of trajectory that led to Nazism, fascism, and World War II, and the aftermath of World War II as well.
And it gets even deeper, that rabbit hole, Dr. Tracy. If you've studied classical German socialism of the late 19th century, it was a fantastic thing, and it was actually implemented in Wisconsin. It took 20 years to get a mayor and a common council in the city of Milwaukee, and real socialism works with industry, works with capitalism to champion the environment and champion the cities. And so what happened when it was real socialism in Milwaukee, they developed one of the best park systems in the Midwest and possibly the nation. They eliminated toxic dumping everywhere, made working conditions decent, got rid of child labor, everything that you'd want to do. And it's sad today that classical German socialism is vilified as communism when communism is so much different.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. There is an attempt to replicate some of the programs of Bismarck in Germany in the latter part of the 19th century here in the U.S. I think that some of these examples are presented to generations today about how great socialism can be, and it arguably can be, but I don't believe that. That what is taking place today and the leaders of this of the Democratic Party have that in mind. they have something much more austere. They have things like, you know, the Green New Deal and all this nonsense that's based on preposterous fraudulent science that they want to foist on the public. And it's just like what's going on with the pandemic. You know, there's no evidence that this is any worse than the flu. Now, maybe it's some sort of a bug that lies dormant for a year, like, you know, the movie Alien, and it all of a sudden it manifests itself as something really much worse than it, you know, than it presently is, and it's being spread now. But barring that, it's something that the body is able to successfully create antibodies for the human body and stave off. And most people have successfully done that, and so they don't have any symptoms. And yet people are still running around scared to death with their masks on, as if the masks are going to do any good. You can't – something we've not brought up is it's interesting how in certain states – and we have it much more lax. It's much more tolerable in Florida than it is in Michigan or in California or New York with some of these Democratic Party governors, because I think they want to make it as worse as possible to sort of justify this whole mail-in voting thing. And of course, the biggest contrast that I think has been pointed out a lot is the fact that you can go to a Black Lives Matter protest and not have to worry about getting coronavirus. But if you're in church, if you want to go worship or something along those lines, then you can't meet in a group of any more than 10 people. It's an incredibly smart virus. Right. It's able to discern between these people, these folks who are going out and upholding a good cause, and these, you know, these evil folks who want to go to church on Sunday. So,
yes, it's the magic virus, Dr. Tracy.
That's right.
And it seems to magically fulfill all the agenda needs and wants that these people have had for so very long. It's hard to believe that our time is we're at the bottom of the hour already. And you said you had to go at the bottom of the hour. So I really want to thank you for coming on the show. This time has really just flown by, and your perceptions and observations have been most fascinating to me, and I'm sure for all the listeners as well.
Well, thanks very much. I very much appreciate the invite and coming on. It's been enjoyable for me as well.
Dr. Tracy.
Great. And we hope to have you on again soon, because I feel like we just kind of scratched the surface with all the things that we could talk about.
Sure, be happy to.
Dr. Tracy's blog is memoryholeblog.org. You can also follow him on Twitter and Facebook. And please follow him and definitely support his noble and heroic effort to restore his good name. As he describes himself, he's an academic in exile, and this is a criminal act being done to him.
Very well said, Giuseppe. And thanks again, Dr. Tracy. And we're at the bottom of the hour break, and we'll be right back. Okay, welcome back to the final segment of the Scorpio Conspiracy Show. I'm here with Giuseppe, my co-host, and we just finished up a really, I think, fascinating and informative discussion with Dr. James Tracy. And I'll just give out the call-in number one more time in case anyone wants to call in just to talk to us two. You've missed your chance to talk to Dr. Tracy. The number is 703-879-8880, 703-879-8880. Giuseppe, what are your thoughts on our discussion?
I am a huge fan of Dr. James Tracy. I consider him a hero, and I consider the satanic forces that have marshaled against him to be absolute despicable evil. And I hope that he wins out in his appellate efforts. And I just messaged him that please consider yourself a friend of show, and we welcome you back anytime. The guy is just so bright, so grounded, so reasoned, and just so knowledgeable. I mean, he's everything you'd want in a real professor. And here, instead, he's an academic in exile by a bunch of lying subhumans who have just come after him for questioning a total false flag.
Yeah, he's an academic in exile. That's very well said. And that, just like Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, he is as well. And it's really quite amazing. I think that Dr. Tracy is actually has very strong grounds for, you know, a countersuit with seven figures of damages for the malicious and deliberate destruction of his career and his livelihood over essentially some posts that he made on a blog. I mean, it's really quite incredible.
A personal blog that he did not in any way seek to associate with the school. In fact, he's stated he went out of his way to make the point that this is his own personal opinions, and they rewrote their rules retroactively to try and make it seem like he didn't get approval and everything, when he, based on the rules, he was told he was well within his rights to do that. And it's so sad because these parasites, you know, can intimidate his union, intimidate the other professors to not support him, because, you know, they'll go after you next. You lose your job, you lose your tenure, your SOL, as they say. And it's just yeah. So it's so criminal. No other way.
Yeah, and you know, Norman Finkelstein actually encountered a similar, you know, set of circumstances when he wrote The Holocaust Industry. I believe his tenure was stripped, or at least they tried to. I'm pretty certain they did.
It was.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is so anti-intellectual, and I think a good academic should be controversial sometimes, because part of the whole point of academia is to make people think.
Right. Yeah, which is something in short supply right now. I mean, we didn't get to ask him. You know, he was talking about the whole Obama traitorous administration and how they were serving the Bolshevik communist agenda for totalitarian control. And I wanted to ask him what he thought of Mayor Lori Lightfoot, who was an Obama appointee and then somehow got elected mayor of Chicago. And I wanted his thoughts on the tweet she posted last week, that blaming Trump for all the gun violence in Chicago and stating that we need national gun laws. It's like, you have the strictest gun laws in the nation in Chicago, and look at your own results. In fact, that's what I tweet replied to her when I saw that.
Not all that great. The results have not been that great. And, you know, it's really ironic, too, that let's say Dr. Tracy had made a blog saying, well, I support, you know, making little children have the right to become transgendered and be, you know, put on hormones. And I support the right, you know, for people to have sex with animals. I think that would have been just fine. I don't think he would have got much of any kind of flack from such thinking, which, you know, it's sort of, you know, morality and sound thinking has sort of been turned upside down on its head.
Yeah, it's absolutely, we've stepped through the rabbit hole and the mind control indoctrination that's occurred in this nation pretty much really began about with the Kennedy assassination. But for the younger people, it's really been in the schools. The schools are horrific now. And it was fascinating when he talked about his oldest of five children, a 14-year-old daughter, who's, you're a racist dad. And you know what? Your dad worked his butt off to get tenure to provide you a good life and get to live in Florida. And he gets stabbed in the back. But yeah, he's a racist and he has such privilege. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's all just such a pejorative accusation anyway. You know, and I, you know, I, as I stated earlier, I come from a family of academics, and you know, it's been said that academia is supposed to teach you how to think, not what to think.
Right. Exactly right. And you need to learn that. And you couple that with the hard knocks of life, which everyone experiences, the major losses, and you're supposed to grow intellectually, you're supposed to grow in maturity, and you're supposed to grow spiritually, and you question everything, and ultimately, if you're a real human, you realize that you need to look inside via prayer or meditation, connect with the divine energy that animates us all, and then be a rational, reasoned, balanced human dealing with the rest of it. And do you see very many of those around anymore?
No, at least not anything that's portrayed on the mainstream media doomcast that they are always putting on. It's really quite sad. And, you know, they're trying to like you said, squash and limit human consciousness and human spirituality. That's part of what's in play here right now.
Oh, majorly in play. And, you know, it's working for a certain segment of the population. I mean, the media totally overblows the how much rioting is going on. And you look at the cities where it's really bad, Portland, Seattle, and they are really controlled by traitorous Bolshevik leadership, the mayor, the police chief and everything, the governor even. And they're just, Dr. Tracy was dead on when he said they're just trying to goad Trump into a Kent State-like event. And he's really been wise to dial back, because his initial response, you could tell he was itching to squash it all. And luckily he got some sage counsel and did not do that, because that would have really blown up in his face.
Yeah, and you know, you brought up Kent State, and so did Dr. Tracy. We didn't get the chance to touch upon this, but there's a lot of evidence that the Kent State shootings were actually another one of these staged events, and we'll have to go into that on a show sometime. But it's really quite a fascinating subject, and there's a lot of evidence that says there's something ain't right here.
Oh, and I love stuff like that. Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, we'll have to do that in the future. And, you know, we didn't get the chance to ask him about, you know, well, who is your favorite Sandy Hook character? Of course, mine is Gene Rosen. I mean, that guy's had to have gotten the Ham of the Year award for, you know, his crying fit and how he wanted to give all the little kids a hug and oh, my God, you know, it was just pretty overdone. Well, who was your favorite character in that play? I mean, event?
My favorite character is they ran out of cash, so they had to have one actor do two parts. I forget the gentleman's name, but he was a grieving parent, and he was strapped up as a fake FBI SWAT guy carrying his gun upside down by the clip, which no one would ever do. And every time he walked near a camera, he tipped his head and tried to not be on the camera, but enough of it caught him. And the proof was in the exact same mole on his lower left chin. Both actors, i.e. the same person, had that. It's like, oh, my God. It's just Dr. Fetzer, who's actually going to be our guest next Friday on The Perfect Triangle, coming back to Rev Radio on Tuesdays, Studio B, 4 p.m. Eastern, plus launching his own venture with some other talented people, Real Deal News. And he has done such an outstanding job of just tearing that false flag apart. And he's come up against Leonard Posner, just like Dr. Tracy. And sadly, the same corrupt judiciary has really screwed Jim Fetzer just the way they've screwed Jim Tracy.
Yeah, at least Dr. Fetzer was already retired before he got too deeply into all this.
Correct.
And also, you know, he was a professor at a different time. You know, I went to college in the 1990s, and things were quite a bit different then. I actually had some pretty incredible professors, and there was a wide spectrum of beliefs at that time, but I could already see it really shifting to the left even then. But now it's sort of become a monoculture, and that's the exact opposite of what academia should be.
Yeah, it's all controlled by the same globalist mega money wielding subhumans. It's really, really so disturbing.
Yeah. Yeah. But I just find it incredible that, you know, this guy, they try to ruin his career over some blog posts that he made, and they try to, you know, change the rules, say, oh, it wasn't because of that. It's because his behavior was inappropriate and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, obviously Dr. Tracy wasn't incompetent, or he wouldn't have been made tenure.
Oh, you and the listeners heard him. He's amazingly intellectual, but plain spoken, and chooses his words carefully, makes his points, has a brilliant grasp of history. And the funny thing is, Leonard Posner, who went after him, he never even questioned Leonard Posner's story at all. He always stuck to the general facts. And it's just, it's so ridiculous, as we discussed when he was here, that it's such a visceral, emotional trigger point for the average schmo, and it's just sad that this country has de-evolved to where that is allowed to be the status quo.
Well, yeah, and they like to encapsulate these stage events with you know, high emotionalism, because that makes it, well, you can't even talk about it. You know, it's beyond discussion. We can't talk about that because, well, you know, it's just too emotional. And that's part of how the mind control has worked so well on the general public.
Yeah, because it's not actually mind control. It's a combination hybrid of mind control and heart control. That's why it's so effective.
Oh, that's a very good point. Very good point. Yes, yes. Heart control. Because, you know, like you said, people love, you know, little kids and puppies, and that's just a part of human nature.
Right. And the sad thing is that if you actually grow up into a mature adult, you never lose that element of your heart that you can open freely and genuinely to a puppy or a baby. But that's saved for those instances. You don't have such a silly, immature, open heart to the lies of the globalist and the idiocy of, we all join together and we grieve the Sandy Hook children together. And now it's like, wear your mask. We're all in this together. I am never in together for anything ever. I am never a part of any throng, period. End of story.
Yeah. And you know, we're all in this together. You know, another one of the sayings that they've really tried to popularize is alone together, which is just so Orwellian and bizarre. You know, it's just, it's hard to believe people are going along with it.
Yeah, it is hard to believe. I mean, some days it actually depresses me, and I have to do a lot of inner work to bring back my balance, because it's overwhelming. It's like you and I and the others on this network and the others who are getting banned from YouTube, banned from Twitter, banned from Facebook. I feel like we're all locking arms, a couple thousand people, and we're standing on the beach, and we're going to block the tsunami of stupidity and the tsunami of, oh, my heart goes out to the Sandy Hook parents. I mean, there's just billions of weak-minded individuals who are so controlled. And is it ever going to change? I don't know.
Yeah, and I think it was Snippets in the chat room that it was saying, Dr. Tracy's dangerous. I could see why they wanted to hush him up. Because, you know, here he is. He's so rational and well-spoken and articulate and actually quite a thinker who analyzes the information that's put in front of him rather than just accepting it at face value. And, you know, it's really strange. It wasn't long ago that academia did not like the intelligence agencies and were highly critical and suspicious of anything the CIA or you know, the NSA told them, and that same went for the media as well. They were very suspicious of this, and actually the left in general did not like the intelligence agencies. And now they're all in lockstep, like, well, all the intelligence agencies said that Trump was, you know, working with the Russians to influence the election. Blah, blah, blah. And it's just, it's hard to believe, the shift, the seismic shift that's happened in, you know, the last 30, 40 years.
Literally how the worm has turned. The left, the classical liberals, were vehemently anti-war. And now, you know, the left is everything, go to war, be prepared to die for Israel. And by the way, speaking of snippets, she's got an excellent blog, snippets-and-slapits.blogspot.com. She puts a lot of time into amassing an amazing array of insightful cartoons and stories, and I advocate every listener to go check out Snippets and Snappets at blogspot.com.
Yeah, and her site is sort of a testimony to how much truth can be communicated through humor. And, you know, this politically correct nonsense is really working to destroy humor, because everything's offensive and, oh, you can't say that, you know. And, you know, the best humor always, always communicates truth, and that's why it's funny.
Well, especially an effective, biting, lucid political cartoon. I mean, the people who can do that well, I just have nothing but awe for, because in one or two panels, maybe four, but one little, you know, 4x3 square, they just drop truth bombs of epic proportion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So that was a really good conversation. And, you know, I honestly think that he's sitting on a major, major countersuit here, because I just don't see any legal grounds for saying, well, you wrote a blog on your own free time. You weren't being paid. You didn't drag the university's name into what you were saying. And therefore, we're going to wreck your career and make you into essentially an intellectual leper. I think there's going to be some serious backlash here. And I really do hope that he launches a major countersuit in the seven-figure range.
Well, much deserved. Sadly, with the corruption of the judiciary at every level, he would have to have a shrewd attorney who filed it in the right court with the right judge. That's the only way.
Yeah, yeah. But hopefully it'll start with him at least getting his tenure back and his position back, because, you know, it's really incredible. Tenure used to be something that was sacrosanct. And if you had tenure, you really couldn't be fired unless you burned the administration building down or killed somebody or something like that. You know, I mean, it was just unheard of.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, like he mentioned, you could hear the reverence in his voice for the academy and Kevin Barrett, Dr. Kevin Barrett, who hosts Truth Jihad on this radio station, who was totally ruined much the same way by the same people a few years earlier in his academic career in UW, University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. And there should be these guilds where experienced, trained, learned people have the power to ply their trade, right? In this case, it's the mind. And it's so sad that this global cancer, these globalists are destroying all of that. And it's really tragic.
Yeah, and they're always talking about diversity, which is fine, but let's have some diversity of thought and some diversity of, you know, understanding. Instead, we have this corporate monoculture that is sort of just sweeping over society like a tidal wave. And it's very sad for, you know, humanity and human progress.
Yeah, it's really like that old band from the 70s and 80s, awesome band, Devo, which stood for de-evolution. We're really witnessing global de-evolution.
Yeah. Well, anything else come to your mind from our discussion with Dr. Tracy that you want to discuss before we hit the top of the hour?
Yeah, I would like to discuss the idea that here's a guy with five kids. And so, you know, you're essentially, he's somehow making it, right? But you're destroying a man's livelihood, a man who is honest. And the but those parasites, they don't care. They see us all as cattle, and the only thing that matters is their agenda. And I advocate all listeners to investigate the James Tracy crime and the many other crimes, and to step back and look at the cancer that's infected this country, infected the media, infected forever the banking system, the monetary system, and see who your real enemy is. Your enemy isn't the idiots protesting in Portland. It's not the weak-minded, violent buffoons who are manipulated. It's the real enemy is that cancer.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're really, they're playing the old divide and conquer strategy here. And, their playbook is kind of the same. And once you start to see the methodology they use, it becomes quite clear when you're witnessing an operation or a psyop. And I think that's one thing that Dr. Tracy alluded to with Sandy Hook. He started to see a lot of, methods and strategies that have been used over and over again. And it started to become like, an uh-oh moment.
Hey, I have a question for you. And as we wind it all down, did you see in the last day or so where Trump did this major goodbye to all his staff before he left to go make a campaign experience in Ohio, and then he told people, you won't be seeing me for a while? It was really bizarre. You have any thoughts on that?
Well, that certainly was a cryptic kind of statement. I don't know what to read into that. What are your thoughts?
Well, I thought the fact that he's come out and said basically there's some very powerful rich people who really hate me. And so I think he's thinking he's going to get a bullet soon. What do you think?
Well, I've noticed in the media, they're always trying to make it sound like Trump was just about to meet with somebody who tested positive for COVID. It's happened three or four times. So-and-so tested positive right before he was supposed to have a meeting with President Trump. And so it's almost like they're trying to plant this seed that, President Trump might get COVID.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the other thing is he you know, like every president, that the weight of that office is detrimental to your health. And he's just not looking good. And I saw a picture of him with a big old bruise on the top of his hand, like he got an IV or something. And there's something going on. Yeah. Yeah. There's something going on. And I don't know. That would really shake everything up. Right.
So. Well, and I have noticed as well that Trump really has aged quite a bit in the last, say, 3 or 4 months, which in and of itself is not unusual. Many presidents, age very rapidly just because of the stress and the workload. But Trump was looking great until about 4 months ago, and he just seems to have aged incredibly. And, there's no way to know what kind of, substances they might be putting in his food or subjecting him to through frequencies. I just don't know, but this has taken a toll on him for sure.
I know he was a real influencer. I, like millions of other men, began to wear our hair just like Trump.
Yeah. Well, he's aged a lot, but he looks a lot better than Joe Biden. And at least he knows what state he's in.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. They showed a video right before I came on to your show of Biden claiming that he was on a bike wearing a mask, wearing his trademark aviator glasses because they make Joe look manly. And he supposedly yelled out that he's got his vice president pick. So, Joe can ride a bike. So nothing wrong with Joe. He's gonna roll by you and try and grope a little bit. But yeah,
did it have training wheels on it, Giuseppe?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, this is an incredible so-called campaign. There's not much signs of it. And, you know, Joe's campaign slogan, Build Back Better, has got to be the worst campaign slogan I have ever heard in my entire life.
Indeed.
Okay, that's it. Guys, that 3 hours with Zip and Vine. Giuseppe, thanks for coming. And
a great show.
Bye-bye.